Welcome to Two Inch Heels, an autobiographical novel of my 11-week odyssey backpacking through Western Europe in 1973 at age 18. Written and read by me, Cooper Zale. This is part 51, Kate and Company. I accompany Kate Clay and her two best friends to see the new movie, Godspell, and engage with these three younger women in philosophical discussions about our generation's path forward. It was a chilly, overcast Saturday afternoon, December 8th, 1973, as Kate Clay and I walked down Manor Farm Road from her family's house towards Horthwith Village's little bus stop at the bottom of the hill. She'd invited me to join her and her mates, who were going to see the new movie version of the musical Godspell, showing at a theater in downtown Oxford. I remembered Kate from that summer 3 years ago when she was just 13. She was extremely shy and had not interacted with me, my brother, or my mom very much. Now at 16, she seemed to have come out of that shell, though still more reserved than her gregarious older brother. She had a look about her that was quite distinctive, with straight brown hair cut short on top and behind the ears and back, but with long bangs tumbling over her forehead and even longer on each temple down in front of her ears. Shy and cerebral like me, she had a thing where she would look down when she was thinking, her hair hanging down, obscuring her eyes and nose, then bring her head up and flip her bangs to the side, revealing her big eyes when she was finally ready to share her thoughts. More so than me, her brother, or her parents, she seemed to have a real fashion sense about her, always dressed with thought when I had seen her. Today she was wearing a knee-length camel-colored wool coat, fake fur-trimmed black gloves, brown and gold plaid knee socks rising above tall, shiny black boots with platform heels an inch higher than mine. With my own big, froed hair, charcoal-colored flared slacks, and two-tone suede heels, a bit worse for wear after 10 weeks of way more use than I had imagined when I brought them, we would have looked the part of a trendy young couple, that is, except for my bright orange down jacket, certainly a bit on the dirty side as well from so much use, that clashed with the rest of my attire, indeed not the least bit fashionable. When we got near the village store at the bottom of the hill, I noticed that there were two young people with long wool coats a lot like Kate's, one looking female and the other maybe male, sitting together at the bus stop across the street from the store. As the two of them noticed us, I could see them sit up straight and launch into what looked like a very animated discussion, talking at each other but also glancing our way. I'm sure just seeing Kate had not piqued their interest, but rather the bloke with the big hair she was walking with. When we got within earshot of their conversation, they quieted. Their gaze darted back and forth between Kate and me, finally focusing on Kate as we stopped in front of them, anticipating her explanation of who that bloke with her was. Kate said way too nonchalantly, "Cooper, these are my mates, TJ and Mackenzie." They both immediately focused intense gazes on me, as 16-year-olds are particularly adept at doing. TJ had reddish auburn hair cut like Kate's, shortened back with long bangs in front of the ears coming down to her chin line. Shorter bangs on the forehead showed off a big round face, but with small wide set eyes and a tiny nose and a big wide mouth below. Protruding from the bottom of her long blue wool coat were horizontally striped gray and white knee socks above tall, shiny black boots like Kate's. Mackenzie had a similar long wool coat, but in black, and short black hair coming straight down and slicked against the scalp. dark eyes and chiseled facial features giving him, her, a completely androgynous look. Unlike his, her two mates, Mackenzie was wearing jeans, black and tight around skinny legs, with the cuffs rolled up above the biggest, shit-kickingest black combat boots you could possibly imagine. None of the three of them were wearing makeup or earrings that might have signaled to me that Mackenzie was perhaps female. Kate continued for my benefit and said, "My mates are going to accompany us to the movie," stopping her introduction right there, not giving her friends any context of who I was or why I was with her. It immediately hit me that they might be jumping to a conclusion that I was some sort of new boyfriend. And in not giving them the real scoop, Kate was playing them, jerking their chains. Sensing the ruse, I tried my best to play along, thinking what a boyfriend might say to his new girlfriend's best friends, meeting them for the first time. What I thought of was something that was totally false, at least the second part, but I said it anyway. "Nice to meet you," I said. "Kate's told me a lot about you two." Hearing me say that, Kate nearly lost it and had to swallow hard to keep the beginning of a laugh from bursting from her mouth. She then took her little ruse up a notch by reaching around and taking my arm with hers. I could see TJ's jaw literally drop, her mouth opening but no words able to come out. Mackenzie wrinkled his, her nose and shook his, her head slowly, trying to process something that just did not compute, then made three attempts to start a sentence. What, when, failing at each. TJ uttered an okay, waving her hands in front of her. It was as if she was trying to clear the air so she could rein in her faculties to cobble an intelligent question together and deliver it to get to the bottom of this subterfuge. "So how do you two know each other exactly?" she asked. Having heard my accent when I spoke, she added, "He's a, you're a Yank, right?" I grinned and said nothing more than my favorite British affirmation, indeed, delivered with my best Monty Python British accent, more misdirected grist for TJ's whipsawed mill. Kate and I were still arm in arm. This was Kate's scene to play out. I was just playing along. Kate hung her head as she was wont to do, her bangs obscuring her eyes, but the biggest shit-eating grin slowly forming underneath. She took her arm away from mine so we were standing separately again, then sweeping her head and hair back with a flip, reported very matter-of-factly the missing context. That my family had lived next door to them 4 summers ago, and I had become Kevin's friend, and that I was currently back from 10 weeks traveling the continent and staying with them for a couple days until I flew home to the States on Tuesday. I was just tagging along. "So the arm-in-arm thing?" TJ queried. Kate shrugged, still with the big grin, but dropped her head again. Mackenzie giggled, maybe more like a stereotypical girl. TJ theatrically flopped back against the bus stop bench, glaring at Kate, but with her own grin saying, "You evil little witch." Kate seemed to react to that characterization as high praise. Mackenzie stood and held out a hand to shake mine, saying, "Nice to meet you, Cooper." TJ finally rose and did the same. I played my usual, "So how did you all meet?" card, and the three of them were immediately engaged. They looked at each other, their eyes darting back and forth. Each seemed to be anxiously waiting for one of the others to start. Finally, they all laughed, at the same time even, as if on some telepathic cue. Kate flung back her hair, her signal she was about to speak, and the other two relaxed into listening mode. Kate explained that the three of them had been schoolmates since primary school. Their families were connected, too, Mackenzie's dad and hers worked together at the Morris Motors factory in Cowley. Mackenzie's mom was a local artist of note. TJ's mom and Madge were best friends, both longtime volunteers at St. Francis Church. TJ's dad was the church vicar and had baptized both TJ and Kate. "But not me," Mackenzie piped up at the mention of baptism. "Not Mac," Kate confirmed. I noted the more masculine-sounding nickname. "My parents were hippies," Mackenzie continued. "I was never baptized. I'm going to purgatory." Mackenzie spoke that last word with a theatrical, physical, and vocal shudder, raising both hands and wiggling fingers in the air with eyes stretched open to the extreme. "My God, child, there is still time to accept Jesus and join the flock," TJ mocked, perhaps lampooning her dad, the vicar. "And yet," Mackenzie pausing for dramatic effect, "I still somehow do not. Why is that? What a lost soul am I?" "Repent," Kate chimed in with a big grin in her mate's direction. "Never," Mackenzie replied, grabbing Kate by the nose and wiggling it. Mackenzie suddenly remembered that I was there and withdrew back to her quiet and docile pose. I noted that the three seemed to have a great understanding and affection for each other, which I, of course, found very satisfying and inspiring even. And I still could not say categorically whether Mackenzie was male or female, which I found intriguing, though I was leaning towards female at the moment, despite the nickname and the monster boots. The bus came and we boarded. Kate sat next to me and her mates on the bench across from and facing us. TJ put her arm around Mackenzie, who cuddled up next to her and rested her head on her shoulder, smiling contentedly as the bus rattled down the road, jostling us all. They looked at me for another prompt to launch into a new conversation, showing me a kind of deference as a relative elder. So I tried my best to play the role they were thrusting me into, deciding we'd talk about the movie we're about to see. I told them that I had not seen Godspell performed as a play or a movie, but I had heard the original cast album, and I really liked the songs and the music. I said that I thought that the three of them would like it as well, and trying to reach out and find ways to make a connection with Kate's friends, I continued, noting that since Mackenzie was begat by hippies, they might enjoy the whole hippie Jesus rock and roll thing in the show's score. "Not sure that's her thing," said Kate, finally indicating Mackenzie was a female-type person. Mackenzie looked at me, nose wrinkled and lips pursed, pondering. "That's my parents' thing. All that peace and love, flower power, sex and drugs stuff. Not really my cup of tea." And then getting more philosophical, she said, "Not really going to change the world at this point, in my opinion. We've moved on. We need to be much more practical, not so idealistic." Kate and TJ nodded their heads thoughtfully like that did make sense. And then, trying not to be too dour, Mackenzie added, "Though I do like show tunes." The hippie wannabe, I felt defensive. Was peace and love, joy for that matter, really passé? Was it worn out as a paradigm to guide the cause? They sensed my defensiveness. Their radar for nonverbal cues was finely tuned. The three of them were quietly pensive. TJ tried being diplomatic, saying that she had heard the Godspell album too and liked the music, saying it was way better than catechism class. And then to Kate, who must have attended those classes with her, "Can I get an amen, sister?" Kate lifted her head, flipped her bangs out of her eyes, and did her best to issue a bright amen. The two young women touched fingers across the space between them. "Well, wait a minute," I said. I wasn't going down without a fight. and let some androgynous 16-year-old dismiss in a couple sentences the whole hippie ethos. There is more to peace and love, I said, to flower power, to sex and drugs even, than just words. I started in on the items in the laundry list. So let's start with peace, I said, flipping up the two-finger peace sign. We're not going anywhere until we stop all this war and violence between us. Look at the Middle East. The Arab-Israeli war could have easily led to a military confrontation between the West and the Soviet Union. How can we evolve as a world with that crap going on? I was in gear, gesticulating, and they noted that and dropped down into respectful listening mode. And then, of course, love, I said. I put my hand over my heart and then pantomimed opening it, sharing the love. The Beatles said it, I said, figuring no one of my generation could question their logic. All you need is love. When we are not hating at, shooting at, fearing each other, then we can lead with love and we change the dynamic. We change the world. I could tell by the facial expressions of the two across from me that they were skeptical, but holding their fire. Kate had her head down, thinking. Despite the tough audience, I wasn't stopping. I was on a roll now. And if we can be at peace and interact with love, I said, then we can create and share joy. I was making this stuff up as I went along, not sure it was really a coherent argument. The joy of just being alive. For me, the joy of travel. For all of us, gesturing with my hands to the three of them and then all the other people on the bus, the joy of being able to be our unique selves, daring to look at Mackenzie for that one. Summing up, I tried to close strong. Peace, love, and joy may sound simplistic, I said, pausing for effect, but still they are profound goals towards improving the human condition. Listening to myself pontificate, it sounded a bit much, so I softened a bit and said, at least I think they are. Now came the harder sell, but I plowed forward. Now peace, love, and joy are the goals, I said, but sex, drugs, and rock and roll are the means, as it were, to get there. I love trying to boil things down to the essence, though maybe oversimplified in this case, but oh well. I was going to see where I could go with this line of argument. I continued, sex has not been my forte, but our parents' generation hasn't been able to deal with it at all. Watch those old TV shows where even mom and dad had to sleep in separate beds. Total denial. Sex is that deep, intimate, pleasurable union between two people that perpetuates the species and acknowledges how we are all connected. Again, not my department as of yet, but I totally get it. It struck me that here I was, an 18-year-old male, talking to three 16-year-olds about the meta of human sexuality on a public bus and essentially confessing my virginity. And drugs, I said, continuing. What we're talking about is altered perception and mind expansion, not just getting drunk like our parents do. Sharing getting high, exploring higher or at least different planes of consciousness. Not just the social lubrication that people have done with alcohol since the beginning of time and adults still do today. Not that I begrudge that whole lowering of inhibitions thing with alcohol, making it easier for people to connect and be emotionally honest with each other. Of course, not so much when you're 16. I realized I was losing my focus getting into talking about drinking. Social lubrication, TJ said, a bit incredulous, having not heard the term before and thinking it comical. Don't adults just drink to get pissed, or maybe just have a glass of wine with dinner? Yeah, pissed, but why? I said. What's the purpose? It's being able to let loose, speak more honestly about your feelings. That's that lubrication thing. we were off on a tangent. Continuing, trying to refocus my argument. Finally, the music, rock and roll, in all its variations, but unified by compelling rhythms in the beat. The music brings us together. It carries the messages we need to hear about peace, love, and joy. The music is all about sex and drugs, Mackenzie noted. Let's do drugs. Let's have sex. Let's do drugs and have sex. It gets a little repetitive after a while. Yeah, I conceded. Sure, there's that, but there's more. Pink Floyd is not just sex and drugs. Dark Side of the Moon is a critique of society. Mackenzie quieted and thought about that. After my initial rant had kind of wound down, the three of them looked at me, still skeptical. Though we were only 2 years apart in age, I felt like there was some sort of chasm between us, like I was on the young end, the tail end of the whole hippie ethos. Me, the wannabe who thought it all was or had been profound. And they were the leading edge of a whole new ethos, still probably mostly undefined, forming on a very different set of principles, more pragmatic and practical ones, perhaps. They were not wasting energy trying to fundamentally transform the world, but just realistically trying to make it work better. To them, the hippies were not the gurus, the trailblazers, just historical oddities, yesterday's news. The big hair was not such a big deal. When we got to the theater, there was a pretty large crowd, including a lot of other older youth. There was one line to get tickets, and then a second longer line once you had your ticket to enter the theater. My three comrades scanned the crowd, and particularly all the other older youth, with great concern. Looking at the three of them, and then looking at the others their age, I noted that none of the other young women had the super fashionable clothes or style of haircut that Kate and TJ had. Having more standard type hair you'd maybe expect on an older teen, it struck me that my comrades, particularly Mackenzie, might be the nerds, weirdos, or even outcasts among their classmates. Kate caught sight of a kid in front of us in the line for tickets, and I heard her swear for the first time. "Shite, Bobby Bricks is here," she said in a low growl, a tone I had not heard her use before. Standing next to me in line, she spun around to face her two comrades behind us, and repeated the news in a low hiss. More expletives came from TJ, and Mackenzie actually stiffened her upper lip, that stereotypical British thing, and looked up at the sky as if asking for some sort of divine assistance. Bobby was in line in front of us, scanning the crowd in line behind him with a scowl on his face. He looked about their age. You could see his gaze focus in on Mackenzie, his scowl getting even scowlier. He said something to the person in line next to him, and then sauntered back towards us, saying loudly, "There's little Mac Wutsy," presumably referring to Mackenzie's nerdiness and androgynous look. Kate issued another growl under her breath and moved to Mackenzie's left side and took her arm. TJ took her other arm. Kate's head dropped, and I sensed she was trying to figure out what to do as Bobby continued to approach us with an angry look in his eyes. She lifted her head with a jerk and focused her big eyes on him. "Hey, Bobby," she said, then pointing to me, "I'd like to introduce you to Mackenzie's cousin, Spike, from the States." It caught me off guard at first, but I quickly got her gambit, including calling me Spike rather than my real name. Kate was in little witch mode again, I guess, and I was impressed with her ability to improvise and struck by her willingness to use full-scale fabrication to achieve her desired result, in this case the worthy cause of protecting her mate from a bully and his verbal harassment. Bobby was maybe 5'9" and slightly built, looking to be maybe 16 like the rest of them. I was 6 foot, 6'2" in my 2-inch heels, with another 2 or 3 inches more of hair on top, depending on the weather conditions that day. Trying to play the Spike character now, I figured I would be more effective launching my own preemptive strike. I exited the line and strode towards Bobby with my right hand outstretched, trying to do so with just the friendliest exuberance. I could see his little assault lose momentum as he shifted his focus to me and my offer to shake his hand, putting out his own hand reflexively. "Great to meet you, Bobby," I said, clasping his hand and shaking it. And then for good measure, I said, "It's a pleasure to meet all my little cousin schoolmates." I assumed he was a schoolmate and hoped it was really true, though it struck me it didn't really matter. It just had to be believable that Mackenzie's cousin, who did not know any better, might think that Bobby was a schoolmate. I threw in little because I figured it would sound more protective somehow, like I was looking after my kid cousin and was definitely older. I could see Bobby's mind struggling with how to process and respond to my greeting, including all its extra juicing of positive energy. Okay, he responded nonplussed. "You really are cousin?" "Indeed," I said, not being able to resist using my favorite British word yet again, though I was playing an American. "I've not seen her for a few years, but I've known her since she was a little kid," I said. Hearing my accent, he said, "You live in the States?" Still incredulous. "Yeah," I assured him. "Detroit. You know, the Motor City? Motown?" "Yeah, I guess so." I could see him struggling to process too much discordant information. I continued my own overly friendly counter-assault, asking whether they had classes together, how long he had lived in Oxford, and telling him a bit about my own travels. With his friends now calling to him to come back because they'd reached the kiosk to buy their tickets, I could see in his eyes that he was feeling like his little bullying sortie was maybe not worth it at this point. He nodded at me and frowned and walked back to his mates. Once he and his friends had purchased their tickets and gone off to the end of the second line to enter the theater, now out of earshot, Kate looked at me with big twinkling eyes and a bigger grin and said, "Nice going, Spike," emphasizing her made-up name for me. TJ seconded her kudos. Mackenzie took in a deep breath and then blew it out between her lips theatrically with puffed cheeks, still looking a bit traumatized by the whole thing, brief as it was. We bought our tickets, and as we walked past Bobby and his mates in the second line, I made sure to stay at Mackenzie's side between her and him. I could see him making a point of ignoring us. We were far enough back in the line so that when we finally got in the theater, most of the seats were already taken. My three companions took a moment to scan the crowd and find Bobby and his friends, who were sitting on the right side about halfway back. Most of the remaining seats were in the first couple of rows. Kate led us down the left aisle to the area between the screen and the front row. Again, my comrades scanned the first and second row from the vantage point of the front of the theater, looking for the best place to sit. Three young women, looking in age like classmates and sitting in the second row, waved at them. Kate and TJ moved forward to take seats in front of them, leaving one between them for Mackenzie. I sat next to Kate. The lights dimmed, and after some coming attractions, the movie began, the screen no more than 10 feet in front of us, some 20 feet tall and 30 across. In the darkness came the sound of wind chimes, with a blowing wind behind them, and the screen lit with a mottled gold surface, with a hexagonal outcropping at the bottom, as a camera pulled out to reveal a graffitied corrugated metal wall, we heard a supple and well-modulated male voice, identifying himself as the voice of God, as the wind continued to blow behind. "My name is known, God and King. I am most in majesty and whom no beginning can be and no end. Highest in potency I am, and have been ever. Little upnote and emphasis on that last word ever identified the voice as young and vigorous and not old and patriarchal, like stereotypical reading of an old man god. Having established its bona fides, the voice continued to describe its creation of the world as a camera panned from the graffitied corrugated metal wall to see that we were below the Brooklyn Bridge, looking across the Hudson River at the contemporary skyline of New York City, featuring the twin World Trade Center towers. The voice continued, "And of this pleasant garden, of which I have mostly goodly planted, I will make him gardener for his own recreation." There was a growing sense of irony as we heard those words and saw the skyline of the massive city up in front and above us in our first row of the movie theater. Finally, the shot changed to cars noisily rushing by across the bridge to hammer home that irony. The camera panned again and found a shadowed figure, later revealed as the John the Baptist character, pulling a cart across the pedestrian walkway on the side of the bridge. Slowly, we could see that he was a young white man with long freak flag hair, mustache, and a beard, in an iconic Jimi Hendrix-style 19th-century cavalry jacket, so stereotypical of hippiedom. The movie title, Godspell, displayed above him along with the subtitle, a musical based on the Gospel according to St. Matthew. I was well in the moment, though detached enough to notice that my three comrades to my right seemed in it as well. The man hummed a melody as the camera revealed that he was pulling what looked like a colorfully painted circus cart across the bridge and into the waiting metropolis. The scene changed to a crowded city sidewalk, the screen filled with the bobbing heads of hundreds of walking pedestrians. Next, the traffic jam of cars in the adjoining street with drivers' voices of frustration and anger. The camera then picked out 8 young adults from the mass of humanity and vehicles. They all started seeing the image of the young man in the Jimi Hendrix jacket, their Pied Piper of sorts, who finally blew his shofar to call them away from their mundane lives. They all heard him begin to sing the musical's first number, "Prepare Ye the Way of the Lord." Each one of the 8 dropped whatever they were doing, kicked off their shoes and discarded their purses, and were willingly drawn to the big fountain of Central Park, where the John the Baptist character was standing and singing out his song. As they frolicked and were baptized themselves in the water of the fountain, the last member of the forming entourage, the obvious Jesus character, was revealed watching the other 9. Shyly but expectantly, from the spot just off the plaza that surrounded the fountain. Detached momentarily from the engulfment of the briskly paced sounds and images, the point of the scene was obvious to me. These 8 young adult people were drawn from their mundane existences to a more compelling and profound call of anticipation and joy of the Lord's coming. Not unlike a few of my neighborhood friends who had embraced Christian religion and pitched me to join them. But though the lyrics were merely the song title sung over and over, the tune and rock score were catchy enough to entice me. In its way, it was the biblical equivalent of turn on, tune in, drop out, that phrase popularized by Timothy Leary. Referring to Jesus, the John the Baptist character then announced someone was coming who was more exalted than he was, who would baptize them with the Holy Spirit, not just plain water like he had, saying, "I'm not fit to even take off his shoes." I was both struck by the sincerity of his deference and discomforted by its extremeness. Yes, I had my mentors and people I looked to for advice and even guidance, my mom, my feminist aunt Mary Jane, Robert, who had run our youth theater group, but I saw them basically as fellow travelers who happened to be farther along the path than I was, and had good wisdom from the journey to share with me, but not operating on some higher plane that I could never aspire to. To John's surprise, the Jesus character then humbly requested John baptize him. As Jesus knelt before him in the fountain, a very catchy and evocative acoustic guitar line began. And as John poured water over his exalted comrade's big mane of teased-out hair, not unlike my own, Jesus broke into the show's second musical number, Save the People, with his quavering tenor voice. When will thou save the people, O God of mercy, when? The people, Lord, the people, not thorns and crowns, but men. The first line of the song, a question, sung with all the Jesus character's tender innocence, grabbed my heart, sent shivers down my spine and goosebumps on the flesh of my arms. The words had unlocked a complicated set of emotions for my inner soul. My homesickness and general emotional vulnerability at this point, my strong feelings that my family and friends needed me to play more of a role assisting them, plus my own messianic vision of my generation's role to save the world from its angry fathers who had lost their own vision of a future of peace, love, and joy. Flowers of thy heart, O God, are they. Let them not pass like weeds away. Their heritage, a sunless day. God save the people. That metaphoric line, their heritage, a sunless day, ping-ponged in my mind, gathering connotations. We humans have yet to rise to our true potential, but my generation would do our part to take our bold steps in that direction. The scene changed to John and Jesus walking into a meadow. Jesus now with clown makeup on his face, Superman t-shirt, suspenders, striped clown pants and shoes. The second verse began, shall crime bring crime forever? Strength aiding still the strong. Is it thy will, O Father, that men shall toil for wrong? More questions from Jesus about the state of our human species and millennia of its sunless sky, questions I resonated with and longed to answer myself. No, say thy mountains, no, say thy skies. Man's clouded sun shall brightly rise, and songs be heard instead of sighs. God save the people. With each of the above lines, one of their other eight comrades appeared from behind the bushes, energized and dancing, now also donned in iconic hippie clothing, colorful t-shirts, oversized blouses, overalls and jeans, silly hats, to join Jesus' troop of followers who believed that we humans could do better. I thought of the lyrics of Elton John's song Tiny Dancer. Jesus freaks out in the street, handing tickets out for God. Getting back to the Save the People song, they were hokey lyrics in retrospect, but in the moment, they were compelling to me and fired my heart and my imagination. Yes, I thought, the sun shall brightly rise, and I committed myself to being part of the effort to make that so. The guitar line intensified in an interlude while the camera shifted to an aerial shot of the 10 of them, just a line of small specks, crossing the big central park, with the city's skyline finally revealed in the background. Hearing the music ramp up and knowing my stage musical conventions, I anticipated that the chorus was about to join in and focus all their combined vocal power. As the interlude completed, the camera shifted to a view of New York City's skyscrapers, featuring so many thousand windows behind which so many people were living their lives. The other eight voices finally join for the third verse. When wilt thou save the people? O God of mercy, when? The people, Lord, the people, not thrones and crowns, but men. God save the people, for thine they are, thy children as thy angels fair. God save the people from despair. God save the people. The camera panned down from the buildings to the street where our entourage of 10 danced along in an otherwise deserted city as the voices repeated, God save the people. Finally, an obvious stop in the music that I knew signaled for the chorus to belt out the final verse of the song with all its combined and concerted energy. I had been a member of those choruses in several musicals, and there was nothing more powerful than all of us on stage turning our focus and voices to the audience and singing out the song's message to them. The camera came in close and moved with the group, showing their faces in profile as they continued to dance forward and sing. The tempo slowed so the chorus could belt out the lyric with all its vocal power. When wilt thou save the people? O God of mercy, when? The people, Lord, the people, not thrones and crowns, but men. The goosebumps intensified on my arms as the epiphany grabbed my mind and vibrated through my body. Kate noted my goose flesh and asked me in a whisper if I was okay. I nodded vigorously, though not wanting to speak or take my eyes from the big screen towering in front of us. Finally, the song was over, and I knew I'd been moved. From where to where, I was not exactly sure, but a significant psychic distance to be eventually calculated. Having been swept up in the first 15 minutes of the movie, the next hour or so was just expertly crafted, performed and shot musical razzle-dazzle. Day by Day was a sappy personal anthem of fidelity to the God Jesus was the avatar for. Turn Back, Oh Man, the standard honky-tonk piano sexy female vamp. Bless the Lord was the next big belted-out chorus number, this one with a nice soulful gospelish Motown feel to it, with the five female characters doing their best Diana Ross in the Supremes or Martha Reeves in the Vandellas imitation. Then a vaudevillian soft shoe, All for the Best, featuring Jesus and John dancing on roofs of buildings and in front of the big Accutron video screen in Times Square as their on-screen silhouettes mirrored their movements. All Good Gifts, another paean to God, like Day by Day. Finally, commandeering a tugboat in the city harbor, the ensemble sang the bluesy Light of the World. You are the light of the world. You are the light of the world. But the tallest candlestick ain't much good without a wick. You've got to stay bright to be the light of the world. The last part of the film got down to the business of the story of the betrayal of Jesus by Judas and others leading to his crucifixion. It was interesting that it was narrated by the John-turned-Judas character, but there was no real indication in the action of the movie or even in the narrative explaining the motivation for that betrayal. There seemed to be a sort of implication that his band of happy-go-lucky hippie followers, when push came to shove, did not stand up for their leader and the principles he championed, and that they had previously sung in the praises of. Somehow Jesus had to die for their sins, and he was tied with red ribbons to the chain-link fence by his followers turned crucifiers. Once he was dead, they untied him and carried his body away, having miraculously seen the light and the error of their sinful ways, singing the final reprise of Prepare Ye the Way of the Lord. as their funeral march through a still-empty New York City turned the corner and went off screen. The camera then followed around that corner to reveal that all the teeming masses of the city had returned and the movie ended. Taken to a high plane of inspired metaphysical perspective by the first 15 minutes of the movie, by the end I was clearly back to earth and pondering instead the craft of the movie maker, songwriter, and cast. We sat and watched all the ending credits as most of the audience behind us made their way out of the theater. When the house lights finally came up, we rose and stretched, and my three comrades looked at me as if deferring to their two-year elder to lead the post-mortem, rather than any sort of pontification on my part, though I had plenty of thoughts to sermonize on at that point. I instead followed my now standard protocol and asked the basic facilitating question. "Well, what do you folks think of the movie?" I asked. They each dutifully chimed in, like answering a teacher in class. TJ first, the alpha, if any, of the trio. She said she liked the Jesus character, and that if her dad's Sunday services had as catchy music and sermons as the movie, she might more wholeheartedly attend church every Sunday. Her report stalled to an unfinished thought, and she signaled to Kate it was her turn to address a question. Kate dropped her head for a long minute, long bangs over her eyes as she thought. She finally raised it and threw back her hair. She cracked a grin, signaling that what she was about to say was in no way intended to be profound. "The lads were all cute," she said, "particularly Jesus." "And John," TJ added, prompting a snicker from Kate and a quick sidebar with her friend that, "You always go for the older blokes with facial hair." It was like they had momentarily forgotten that I, an older bloke, at least relatively speaking, though without facial hair, was part of their conversation. But then realizing, looked at me fretfully. Mackenzie rolled her eyes and said, "Teenagers." Her comrades and I laughed, and I added, "Hey, I'm still a teenager too." As we talked, I could see TJ and Kate keeping their eyes on their other schoolmates that had been in attendance and were now leaving a theater, tracking presumably where Bobby was and possibly other bully types I was not aware of, with the goal of avoiding another encounter like we had had in the ticket line. When it was basically just the four of us left in the theater, other than the young guy who worked there and was cleaning up, TJ gave the nod to leave. On the bus home, the three of them conversed about the movie, which characters they liked, whether the story was consistent with the book of Matthew, and related to that, whether TJ's minister dad would approve or not of that telling. I listened mostly, not really qualified to talk to the second or third item, and conflicted about the first and about the movie generally. The one character I had resonated with initially was Jesus himself. He had been portrayed as a shy alpha full of provocative ideas and other thoughts, like I saw myself, at least at my best. He led by means of those ideas rather than by force of will. The John/Judas character was obviously intended to be Jesus' foil as John and later also his antagonist as Judas. But it did not make sense that that character would betray Jesus for money. I could not recall any moment where John was turned from being Jesus' number one acolyte to being his mortal foe. The motivation for that turning would have made for an interesting story, but if it was there, I had missed it. There was only some narration by John, now Judas, in the final scene that he had betrayed Jesus for money, and implying that some of the others had betrayed him as well, a weakness in the writing of the script, I thought. And all the other eight characters were ultimately disappointing to me as well, because none of them rose to the occasion of Jesus' predicament and betrayal until after he was crucified and dead. They had acted too much like sheep, his flock, as they say, lacking much differentiation from each other. But okay, it was a musical, and they were basically the show's chorus, stepping forward in a scene to temporarily play a character to help tell a particular parable that Jesus wanted told to illustrate an idea. I had wanted them to be more of a cohort, Jesus' strong allies, and not just a more passive chorus whose job was only to reinforce the messages from the lead character and the writer behind the lyrics. As my three comrades proceeded with their conversation, I continued to stew in those thoughts, telegraphing more and more my discomfort, until Kate noticed and gave me an, "Okay, what's troubling you? Spill it. Look." I was immediately impressed with her assertiveness, and again that nearly telepathic thing that happened between the three young women who knew each other, and apparently me, so well. TJ and Mackenzie caught Kate's look at me, read it, and they quieted and all turned their gazes in my direction, giving me deference and the floor to speak. I looked at the three of them and held my hands in front of me, palms inward, using my hands as I often did to help congeal and align my thoughts into a hopefully coherent stream of words. In this case, as if pantomiming, pulling those thoughts out of my mind. I then opened my hands towards my comrades and spoke. What was John/Judas's motivation for betraying Jesus? I did not see him as motivated by money. Kate looked down, thinking. I could see in Mackenzie's eyes she was pondering as well. It was TJ that was quick to respond with a burning load of thoughts. She said that Judas was indeed motivated by money. He could not accept Jesus' teachings that the meek shall inherit the earth, that though the rich people might get more than their fair share in this life, the poor people would be rewarded in heaven. Judas thought the poor people should take what was rightfully theirs in the here and now, and he took his own payoff. I replied that I got that someone could feel that way and betray his principles for the money, but where was it indicated in the script that John/Judas felt that way? Wasn't he the one concerned for the well-being of the poor people? She noted the song All for the Best. Jesus was arguing that it was all for the best for the poor to get their reward in heaven. Judas turned those words the other way, complaining that it was not fair in the here and now that all the bounty of the earth was all for the best, that is, all for the rich. I acknowledged that she obviously knew the song, the musical, and the Bible way better than me. She seemed pleased at that acknowledgement, particularly one coming from a male-type person a couple years older than her. I was enjoying my philosophical intimacy with her in our exchange of ideas. I could see in her eyes she was feeling the same. I said that I still had a problem with the John/Judas character's motivation, from Jesus' main advocate and advance man to his betrayer. She responded that yes, they had combined two characters from the Bible uncomfortably into one, but it did make for a powerful irony that Jesus' chief acolyte became his betrayer. And finally she conceded that yes, the whole turning was not well told in the script. "So," I said, grabbing their attention and looking each of them in the eyes. Since I was feeling more comfortable and safer with my conversation partners, the shy alpha in me burned to be provocative, like Jesus in the movie. I assumed that persona of the elder, the mentor, straightening my posture, squaring my shoulders, and puffing out my chest a bit as if going into character. Showing my most drippingly ironic look, I asked, "Is it indeed all for the best?" The question was ambiguous, and I knew it, but that was basically the point. Mackenzie smiled immediately. I could see Kate wrinkle her nose as she tried to parse it. Then I guess, getting the ambiguity, she grinned and dropped her head to ponder an answer. TJ got a fierce look in her face, like she was a predator about to strike. I enjoyed seeing that fierceness. Pleased she was unbowed by her elder. Based on Jesus or Judas' point of view, the words burst from her mouth. I chuckled, countering her energy with my own. Your point of view, I said, pointing at her. Pick Judas, pick Judas, Mackenzie quietly chanted, diminutively waving her hands in front of her in a mock cheerleader move. I could see Chi-J loving her comrade's playful insurrection as it acknowledged her alpha status. Still, it was an insurrection and had to be dealt with. And TJ gently smacked Mackenzie on the shoulder with the back of her hand, saying, "Shut up, pestilence." Mackenzie theatrically stiffened up and in a robotic monotone said, "Pestilence shutting up." Then, pestilence shutting down, dropping her head and closing her eyes. Given she had smacked her comrade into silence, all TJ had to offer initially was, "I don't know." From her shutdown state, the robotic voice emanated from Mackenzie again. "Just a teenager," soliciting another playful smack from her mate. Chastised now to speak her mind, TJ continued, "I mean, I see both points of view, Judas's and Jesus's. Is it fair that some people are rich and others are poor? Well, some people with money work hard for what they get, but others not so much. But in the end, it's not about the money. You can't take it with you, as they say. It's about your moral choices." I could see her get a little tentative, ending with a, "Isn't it?" Kate had raised her head and was pondering TJ as she listened to her mate's thoughts, finally adding, "I suppose you could say it is a moral choice of society to decide whether it's okay for there to be rich people and poor people." Again, as with her mate, spoken tentatively like she was supplying an answer to a test that she wasn't quite confident of. Awakening and speaking with a sing-songy little kid voice now, Mackenzie said to me, "Teacher, teacher, what's the right answer?" No smack from TJ this time, we all quieted and thought. My thoughts went to John and Jesus in the movie. They had a cause, a mission. In their case, prepare ye the way of the Lord that their flock bought into, at least until the shit hit the fan. So what was my cause, my mission, and would I stick to it if the going got tough? I was no catcher in the rye like Holden Caulfield, though I loved that book. Was I a visionary like Jesus, a rabble-rouser like John, or a member of the chorus? Still a critical role, one of Bowie's young dudes who would carry the news. And what was that news? Was it peace, love, and joy? Those were all good things, but could they alone really get the job done, move our society forward? Lance's cause on the ship across the North Sea seemed to be just sex, drugs, and rock and roll, more about the pleasurable means than the ends. My cause was somewhere in Butch's and Bublil's vision of a transformed world, in Trix's, Jen's, and Monica's determined alpha swagger. That was the news I wanted to carry. Ready to move on to a related topic, Mackenzie said that it was scary, but she had seen pictures of her parents from their hippie days wearing clothing not unlike the costumes of the characters in the movie, like brightly frocked, naive children dancing around and handing out flowers, but missing no opportunity to get high and have sex, she said. I saw it from her eyes, and it was all kind of laughable and pathetic, even. The hippies had ultimately failed. Theater had failed as well. It had so powerfully made the case, at least to me, for the hippie ethos back in 1969, with naked people singing on stage in the musical Hair. That had inspired me to plunge into the theater world myself. Now in 1973, with the musical Godspell, it seemed that it was all smoke and mirrors, craft and pyrotechnics. Even worse, it was nostalgia, of all things, with no compelling call to action. Finally, it was the end of the line, at least for the bus. At the little convenience store at the bottom of Horsepus Hill, the four of us exited and stood together at the bus stop. It was already getting dark and cold. TJ said that she and Mackenzie were going to study for end-of-term exams at her house. Kate said she would join them later. TJ stuck out her hand to me, saying, "Been a pleasure." I took it and thanked her for the great conversation and wished her luck on her exams. Mackenzie did her imitation of the same routine, and I responded in kind. They told Kate to give their love to her mom, and the two of them then headed off up the other road into the village. Kate and I walked back up Manor Farm Road. She had done her good deed for the day, getting their house guest, me, out of the house for the afternoon so her mom could have her clandestine snort of scotch and indulge in a romance novel and who knows, maybe what else. 4 hours ago, when we left their house to walk down to the bus stop, Kate had just been Kevin's younger sister. Now I had had a glimpse into her soul, the little witch, as it were, but a good witch. I had engaged with her two best mates and gotten a glimpse of the world the three of them lived in. They were now three more of the intriguing young women I had met on my European odyssey. The experience of the movie and our philosophical conversations around it, including Mackenzie's critique of the hippie ethos, had made its mark on me. But rather than continue to talk about that, or anything else for that matter, we walked up the road together in silence. I felt I had connected with her and her comrades. She had employed me, without asking, in a brief playful ruse that I was her boyfriend. She had later employed me in another less playful ruse as Mackenzie's cousin, and directed by her, I had risen to the task of deflecting a bully intent on giving her comrade Mackenzie a hard time. She had briefly let me into her world, or at least I felt like she had. Now it felt like things were going back to how they'd been before we left the house together. I was her brother's friend, and she was his teeny bopper sister. I felt like it would not be appropriate to share with her brother, her mom, or dad the highlights of our afternoon together, and that she and I had made any sort of connection. Again, we did not talk about it, but that seemed like the unspoken understanding. When we entered the house, Kevin was not back from his shift at the garage, but Bill and Nana were back from the pub. Madge quizzed me straight off. "How was the movie?" she asked. I nodded vigorously. "It was really good. Great musical numbers, good performances." "And you met TJ and—" Madge paused just ever so briefly. "Kenzie?" I noted she used the second, more female half of Mackenzie's name. I caught Kate subtly rolling her big eyes. I couldn't quite tell whether it was just an unguarded response or more calculated for her mom's or my consumption, or both. Regardless, I could see Madge noting it with a slight nod and a knowing, determined chuckle, as if to say, "Yes, dear, I'm going to call her Kenzie, though I get that you think otherwise." "Yes," I replied, tempted to add, "indeed," but deciding that I had already overused that wonderful word, I said, "good friends," instead. Kate, who seemed pleased with my terse responses, said to her mom, "TJ and Mac send their love." It seemed to me that Kate was underestimating her mom by not sharing with her more of her thoughts and the trials and tribulations of her life. But then I remembered being pretty much that way, too, when I was 16. So concludes the 51st chapter of Two Inch Heels, only two more to go. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for the next chapter, where after 11 long, eventful weeks, I board my plane home.